Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by Sheen.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Howard, let's start there. Let's start with the Trump comment that recently came out about the case, asking the judge and incentivizing the judge, the request from the president to make him tell us why he did it.
Well, yeah, I've known Donald Trump. I knew him 100 years ago when I was a reporter at the Times. I did a piece on him back at the tail end of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. He took me to the tennis matches at Forest Hills a couple of times. I remember him picking me up in front of my apartment building in New York City in a long limo, and he was driving the limo himself. His chauffeur was off that day. So, and in the course of those years since then, there hasn't been, I can't think of one other occasion that I've ever agreed with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But today, no matter what his reasons for saying it, perhaps his distraction technique from his other concerns, but his calling on Hitler to take a stand, well, I support that. I don't think Hitler will be moved in the least, but
yeah,
I'm supporting that. I feel, it's a travesty of justice that Coburg can get away with just his terse responses at the sentencing hearing.
Well, especially now that this has sunk in a little bit, we're not just, on that shocking day where Koberger came out and admitted to the guilt. We've had a chance to kind of digest this. We've had a chance to hear the families out, hear what they've had to say and their various reactions to all of this. And, a couple of weeks out of this, how are you feeling about this? I mean, this does seem like a travesty, the fact that he's not going or he doesn't have to say anything. Is that the one thing that can happen here in this case now, is a forced explanation, not just confession, but explanation to try?
I'm not sure how forced it can be. I mean, the judge only has certain legal powers. Koberger is protected by Ann Taylor. Mm-hmm. I don't think he has to say anything. I think all this will remain hidden till he's sitting in his jail cell 10 years from now, and then he'll decide, I'm bored stiff. Why don't I tell all? Why not? You know, his vision was to become a forensic psychologist, a criminal justice specialist. Well, sometime down the road, I think he will achieve his lifelong ambition. He will become a forensic psychologist. Other forensic psychologists will come knocking on his jail cell, eager to talk with him.
It's almost like he's getting what he wants. Robin?
Yeah, I agree. And that's the travesty here is that I think he's going to potentially get exactly what he always wanted. So, Howard, I'm curious about this. And I'm always kind of the glass half full until it spills over anyway. And, you know, the prosecutor, Bill Thompson, has got a really strong reputation of just being hard-nosed. You know, they said he's a hammer with a velvet glove. And all along during the investigation and all that's going on, we've always been a little amazed about how silent he's been or how acquiescent he's been to the defense. But so here's my hope. And this, I sometimes go out on the conjecture thing, but kind of taking in all the data that you've hypothesized with the targeting of Mattie Morgan, Mogan, as well as other people saying the same thing. Here's what I'm hoping. And here's what I'm maybe thinking, again, benefit of the doubt to Bill Thompson on this. Many, many times, upwards to 60 to 70% of the time, when you have a stalking of an individual, so let's presume that Coburg was stalking Mattie and he had targeted her. Many, many times there's journals, there's writings, there's something that goes behind that stalking. And since Coburg has been online earlier in life, kind of talking about his life and everything, I'm holding out hope until not that one of the reasons why Bill didn't go for an explanation is because maybe with the unsealing of documents, we might get some sort of an explanation if it's in there. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that might happen?
I think that's wishful thinking.
I think it is.
inside the velvet glove is a velvet hand, not a hammer. You know, Thompson gave his statement at the plea deal, and his statement was pretty much the same as the first affidavit that was introduced just after Coburger's arrest. Mm-hmm. He had no details there. If he had anything there, he would have, I think, shared it, but he didn't.
What do you think about, I mean, if we were to theorize and say this thing actually did go to trial, which we were all expecting, and Bill Thompson was going to be there as the prosecutor, and now that we know, obviously, Coburger took the plea, how confident are you that this would have been a successful conviction with Bill Thompson behind the wheel?
I think he would have delivered, actually. Yep. I think the DNA evidence was so strong, and then combined with the more circumstantial evidence, it created a mosaic where all the pieces merged, and it could only be Coburger.
Yeah. I want to ask about your thoughts right now or any insight you might have on the family of Brian Coburger, his parents. Earlier on when it was announced that Coburger was going to be pleading out, Steve Gonsalves had made a fairly angry statement against the DA and this frustration with him, saying, we know, and I'm paraphrasing here, when the tickets were bought, essentially insinuating that Coburger's family may have had more of a heads up on this plea acceptance than the victims actually did. What's your thoughts on that and anything you know on that right now about, you know, were they giving a little extra, you know, help to the family of Coburger over the families of the victims themselves when it came to getting this whole thing put together?
I don't know if they were giving extra help. What I think happened was that Ann Taylor was just more expeditious in moving things forward than Bill Thompson was. I mean, she notified the family right away as soon as the plea deal was settled, tell them to get out to Boise. And Bill Thompson just didn't even notify the parents till later.
Do you think that this was a result, again, now that we have a little more time and distance between this happening, that it was the motive of the mother that moved Coburger to accept this deal?
I still believe in that. I still believe that Coburger finally made his plea deal, finally agreed to a settlement because he feared that his parents would be implicated, that they would have to get on the stand and answer questions under oath, and this could impact them. Plus, of course, the fact that now he wouldn't have to face the long guns of firing squad.
Robin?
You know, I keep going back to trying to understand, you know, where he kind of falls, that being Koberger, in the scope of, you know, because right now the definition of what he did falls in line with mass murder, not serial killer yet. You know, but we keep theorizing, I do at least, you know, that this probably would have continued. And part of that is if he's targeting people, I'm also curious, you know, with the gag order slowly being lifted, but slowly trickling out, in any of the research that you did along the way, I'm going to do the worst thing. I'm going to ask two questions at once. Did you see an escalation? Because a lot of times, you know, there's an escalation of violence, an escalation of resentment and things like that that reached that breaking point, which we didn't quite see. At least that's been documented, that has been released yet. Also, the second part of that is, do you think from what you've seen and the interviews you did, do you think there was anyone that you could identify? You know, you don't have to do it by name, but do you think he had another target in mind after this?
To the first part of your question about an escalation, mm-hmm. Yes, there was a dramatic escalation. When he first went out to Washington State, before he even made that journey, he bought the knife and the mask. So in some part of his mind, I believe he was thinking about becoming a monster, thinking about becoming a killer. He goes out to Washington State, and he tries to integrate into the world of normalcy, to become a person who can go to pool parties, to teach students as a teaching assistant at Washington State. But none of it works. None of it works. And finally, he meets this woman. Doesn't meet her. He sees her, I think, in the Mad Greek restaurant. There's no evidence that he ever followed her on social media. Right. If that existed, it'll be out there. If he ever spoke with her, that would be out there. And this is a secret. He focused on her for his own obsessive reasons. Was it her blonde exuberance? Something like that, I believe. And I think down the road, he would have killed again. I bet his next target would have been another young, vivacious blonde, another rebuke to the world that he was living in. I think the thrill of killing would have left inside him a feeling that he had become what he wanted to be, and he wanted to have that, you know, thumbs up, felt selfie. He wanted to do that again someday.
Yeah, that timeline you highlighted is really critical of him buying that, those things before he even went out there, before he even met supposedly Maddie at a restaurant that he attended and stuff. So yeah. Thanks for that.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
You ever fall into a rabbit hole online, and then after you've been in that rabbit hole for a while, you come out the other side wondering how humanity is still functioning? Yeah. That's why researching the incel movement and the community is quite the rabbit hole. And it's one you want to get out of because it just feels icky inside. What began as a lonely internet forum for the romantically unsuccessful, it does have fairly innocent beginnings. And is actually started by a woman. And it's devolved into something that has absolutely nothing to do to its original intent. It's devolved into something very sinister, a digital wasteland where bitterness curdles into misogyny and isolation fuels ideology. Welcome to the world of involuntary celibates, everyone, or incels. It's a subculture that's no longer just sad or strange, but it's dangerous. Very dangerous. And we're going to break down here in the next four episodes is what it's all about. Because we hear the term quite a bit, we talk about it quite a bit, because unfortunately, it seems a lot of the folks we end up following on this program that end up being killers seem to have tendencies of incels. So it's best to have an understanding of what it's all about. We're going to talk about Elliot Rodger, maybe the Roger inspiration for the Papa Roger of Brian Koberger and the online persona. We're going to talk about what he did, what others have done in his name, and how this bizarre, dark, self-destructive disorder, because it ain't a lifestyle, it's a disorder, does, and how to spot it before it's too late in those around you. So press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our four-part coverage on this. And also, let me know what you think in the comments section. So in this first episode of this series, we're going to be cracking open the festering underbelly of the incel world, its origins, its warped beliefs, its psychological roots, and why law enforcement is now calling it a domestic terror threat. If you thought this was just about guys not getting dates, well, buckle up. It is far, far more than just that. So, what is this? What is the incel movement? It's short for involuntary celibate, a term that once had a benign origin story. It was coined in the 1990s by a Canadian woman trying to create a supportive online space for people struggling with romantic rejection. Think of it as a early Reddit meets a therapy chat room. Vulnerable, awkward, human. But then the internet did what the internet does. It twisted vulnerability into venom. Over time, men, primarily young and heterosexual, dominated the space. The tone shifted from support to self-pity, from loneliness to loathing. What was once a shared pain point became a manifesto of entitlement and rage. Today's incel community largely resides in digital echo chambers, forums that exist out there. I'm not going to name them here, but they're out there. Certain threads on message board, obscure corners of Reddit before they were shut down, where users reinforce the belief that women are to blame for their misery. They believe the dating world is a rigid game where shallow women chase genetically superior men and the rest are left to rot. The modern incel doesn't seek connection or change, however. He wants validation for his resentment. Yeah, nothing like looking in yourself and saying, maybe it's me. Maybe there's something I'm doing that's making me not attractive to the opposite sex. Could it possibly be that? Nah, it's them. It's a very infantile way of thinking. So, the incel worldview, it operates like a dark fantasy novel, complete with its own terminology. You ready for this? The term Chad, a conventionally attractive, confident guy who seemingly has unlimited access to sex and affection. This is from the incels' perspective of what they think they're seeing out there. Then there's the Stacy, the blonde bombshell archetype who incels see as shallow, manipulative, and sexually available only to Chads. The incel, meanwhile, casts himself as the tragic anti-hero, kind, intelligent, and invisible. They speak of normies with disdain, viewing average people who engage in successful romantic relationships as deluded sheep. And then comes the black pill, the philosophical backbone of inceldom. Unlike the red pill, popularized by men's rights activists or activists as a supposed awakening to society's feminist lies, as they say, the black pill is nihilistic. It's the belief that nothing can ever improve. That no matter how much self-work you do, your fate is sealed by your jawline or your height. It's predestination in a basement is basically what it is. Taking the black pill means giving up on self-improvement. It's a descent into fatalism. It says you're doomed and your women and women are your worst enemy. You know, a real healthy outlook on life. The incel identity could have remained a sad corner of the internet, but over the last decade, it's evolved into something far more disturbing. As those platforms like Reddit and YouTube crack down on overt hate speech, incel communities became more insular, more radical. These aren't just forums for venting anymore. They're breeding grounds for resentment, contempt, and in some cases, violence. The shift towards extremism came in waves. Initially, the language was passive. Passive-aggressive, you could say. Women were hyper-glamorous or gamorous, always dating up. Irrational, or only attracted to status. But slowly, the darker tone took over. Posts began glorifying violence against women or women, praising mass shooters like Elliot Rodger, who we'll get into in just a little bit, and fantasized about a dystopian world where sex is rationed and women are punished for choosing partners. The language became militarized, basically, calling for an incel rebellion. References to a beta uprising, a culture of martyrdom emerged, where men who committed acts of violence were hailed as heroes. Elliot Rodger wasn't just a killer, he was canonized. This wasn't frustration anymore, it was ideology. And that's dangerous. When you take some sort of anger or hate or view of a slight, as a lot of it would start, and you never look at yourself, you never look at, well, how can I live a better life? How can I make things work out better for me? But that black pill culture is what they live on. There is no self-improvement. It's everyone else is wrong and I'm right. And that's it. Eventually, you would think people would snap out of that and maybe want to improve, or others choose to destroy. And that's where you get the Elliot Rodger or the Brian Koberger. It's easy to characterize incels as greasy teenagers shouting into the void, but the psychology is a lot more complicated and deeply troubling. According to mental health studies, many incels struggle with severe depression, anxiety, and feelings of social rejection. One study found that nearly 20% of incels experience daily suicidal ideation. It's not a red flag. That's a five-alarm fire. Neurodivergent traits are also overrepresented. A significant number of incel forum users exhibit signs of autism spectrum disorder, social communication difficulties, and anxiety disorders. This doesn't excuse the ideology, but it does explain why many members struggle to form social bonds and experience isolation and gravitate towards more rigid belief systems. The most important psychological factor, though, is what researchers call aggrieved entitlement. It's the belief that these men are owed love, affection, and sex, owed it. And that the denial of these things is not just unfortunate, but unjust. It's not just self-pity, it's perceived injustice, and perceived injustice is a powerful motivator, especially when it finds community and reinforcement. Incels believe women hold all the sexual and romantic power in modern society. That power, in their eyes, is not earned, but stolen. So instead of viewing women as equals or even as individuals, they become villains in a rigid, rigid system. This cognitive distortion, combined with a lack of healthy social interaction, it creates a feedback loop of resentment, basically. So how does someone go from a sad sack with a blog to a domestic terror threat? The product of radicalization within incel forums is disturbingly predictable. It starts with isolation, maybe from trauma, bullying, or mental illness, or a combination of it all. The person seeks connection online and finds others who feel the same. And instead of being challenged, their beliefs are validated. Instead of being guided to help, they're given ideology. And once inside the bubble, every bad date, every job rejection, every slight becomes evidence of a conspiracy against them. The posts they read glorify men like Elliot Rodger and Alec Minnison. These aren't cautionary tales. They're role models to them. Every time another man commits a violent act and leaves behind an incel-flavored manifesto, the forums light up like it's the 4th of July. Memes are made. Acronyms like ER, Elliot Rodger, are thrown around as slang. The internet makes a martyr of a murderer. The rhetoric escalates. Members go from passively consuming hate to producing it. They write fantasy stories about killing women. They plan hypothetical attacks. They fantasize about legislation that would force women to have sex with them. Because that's how it works. Legislation, guys. Go for that. It's not just unhinged. It's a breeding ground for real-world threats. Authorities were slow to act on the threat of incel violence because for a while, who took internet nerds seriously, right? But then the bodies started piling up. After Elliot Rodger murdered 6 people in Isla Vista in 2014, Alec Minnison drove a van through a crowd in Toronto, killing 10. Scott Borelli walked into a yoga studio and opened fire. Chris Harper Mercer shot up his community college. All of them referenced incel ideology, either explicitly or through online activity. Eventually, law enforcement began to see a pattern. In 2020, Texas law enforcement issued a bulletin warning that incel ideology has the potential to eclipse other domestic threats. The U.S. Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center followed suit, identifying misogynistic extremism as a growing source of mass violence. Now, behavioral threat assessment is part of a playbook. Officers are trained to look for signs, obsessive messaging, idolization of violent figures, disturbing online activity. But the challenge remains. There's no clear profile. You can't predict who will snap. Some quietly plot. Others explore. And then they explode suddenly. The internet provides both the fuel and the anonymity to help them do it. It's not just about creepy forums. It's about real women who get harassed, stalked, and in some cases, killed. Like Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, and Zana Kernodle. And the man, the Chad, as Brian Koberger likely saw him, Ethan Chapin. Collateral damage. With rage. Now these folks normalize this hate under the guise of free expression. It's about the boys in high school reading these forums instead of talking to a counselor. It's about the social shrug we give to male loneliness until it turns violent. Incels don't exist in a vacuum. They're the product of a culture that shames males vulnerability, but rewards dominance. They emerge from childhoods where emotions were either ignored or punished. And when they hit puberty and encounter rejection, there's no toolkit for how to cope. And they turn to rage and Reddit. Fixing this isn't just about deplatforming or calling people out. It's about addressing the underlying issues that incubate incel ideology. If you want it to change, you got to look at what is causing this. And that means serious investment in mental health for young men. It means reshaping how we talk about masculinity, not as dominance or stoicism, but as resilience, empathy, and connection. It means creating real-world alternatives to online radicalization, mentorships, peer support, actual inclusive sex education. It also means not looking away. The more we pretend this is just a fringe internet noise, the more we allow it to grow. The incel community thrives on neglect. They believe no one understands them and society doesn't care. So, Let's try and understand the threat they pose. And by cutting off the pipeline that feeds it. So yeah, this isn't just about guys who can't get dates. It's about ideology, mental illness, misogyny, and violence all stirred together into a toxic stew and served cold on anonymous message boards.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
In most murder investigations, there's a moment where the cops knock on the door, ask a question, push a little, wait for someone to crack. But in the Brian Koberger case, none of that happened. They didn't knock. They didn't ask. They didn't need to, because by the time they showed up with handcuffs, they already had the map. From cell tower data to surveillance video to genetic genealogy, law enforcement in this case built what might be a very airtight digital case in recent memory, probably one of the best. And they did it in near total silence. No press leaks, no suspect interviews, just layers of technology, patterning, and restraint. It started with a knife sheath found next to one of the victims that produced a single trace of DNA. Not a national criminal database, but enough to trigger forensic genealogy. From there, they followed a digital echo, a car seen on footage, a phone that went dark during the murders, but lit up just before and after. A set of license plates quietly switched out during the investigation. And through all of that, not a single knock on Koberger's door until the arrest. That's not just good police work. That's calculated. That's pressure from afar. And in this episode, we're joined again by former FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer to break down how law enforcement built this web and how they did it without triggering a single defensive move from the suspect until it was too late. We'll talk about the role of the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, how agents read absences like a dark phone as clues, how seemingly minor details like swapping license plates or overly cleaning a car becoming a huge red flag under behavioral scrutiny. We'll also dig into the psychology of what it feels like to be watched without knowing it, and how that slow, silent pressure often reveals more about a suspect than direct questioning ever could. Let's talk about how you catch someone who thinks they're already outsmarting the system without them realizing they're already in the trap. Let's talk about the investigation a bit. This is an interesting one. This is one where they didn't sit down and question him. What do you know about this? It was an immediate arrest. Once they knew at least who they thought was their guy early on, they came in and broke the door down at his parents' house in Pennsylvania. In a case like this, how rare is it to see a case to be this tight without ever interviewing the suspect, without ever having any sort of, you know, conversation with mom or dad or people next to him before they go in and make that arrest? That must show that they were very, very confident from the start that this is their guy.
Yeah. You know, when you have a case like this, first of all, you can imagine the fright that gripped Moscow, even though early on the messaging was, no, there, nobody needs to be worried mm-hmm. about this. This is just a targeted event, right? Mm-hmm. And then slowly the truth really came out. And I think they just, their messaging was so horrible. As many of us said, listen, you have somebody capable of killing four people out there. This community is definitely not safe. And certainly the FBI knew that and law mm-hmm. enforcement knew that. And so the full court press and the ability of them to really put this case together with a, you know, approximate 20-page probable cause affidavit, which was just part of the evidence they had. They went in there strong. Remember, too, they received very special from the judge. They received the special ability to go in even before the normal hours of a hit, what we call a hit, right? At mm-hmm. 6 a.m., they went in before that. And this is very rare. And it shows that they very specifically were so concerned that if they didn't have surprise and speed and violence of action, that, in other words, they couldn't call him out. They didn't want to go out when he was awake and could perceive them. He could take hostages. He could kill his parents. He could kill himself and his parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were so many terrible scenarios when everybody really looks badly and says, why was this a huge SWAT operation? Well, that's why, Tony. Mm-hmm. They needed to get in and on him quick. They did try to interview him. And initially, he started interviewing with them. And then he shut it down and asked for an attorney.
Really?
Yes. Yep. Right away, they tried to interview him. And there were... there was a spontaneous utterance made immediately upon arrest where he said, yes, words to the effect, did you arrest anyone else?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's been huge speculation. Mm-hmm. Remember early on, everybody thought, oh, there's a co-conspirator. Some people thought, no, that's a ruse. Bundy had done a similar ruse. Mm-hmm. And then I really thought he was worried about his parents, mm-hmm, like harboring him. That's kind of what I lean toward. But I think any of those, the latter two could be possible. Also him, you know, throwing out the ruse. But I really thought he might've been concerned about his parents, the fact they could that be harboring. But yeah, they did a very short interview and then before he invoked his rights.
One thing I wonder about with that, as we now look back on everything and now we're going to see more that the gag order has been lifted, is did Koberger try to steer the investigation anywhere else? Obviously, they only had the knife sheet there as far as his DNA on it, and now we're learning more about that footprint. But other than that, there wasn't a lot to go on from the beginning. And the fact that he's asking, was there anyone else? It does make you wonder a little bit. Did he have the foresight in this to try and point them in another direction? Obviously, he was trying to do that a bit. If, in fact, that was Papa Roger on Facebook that was saying, oh, the Honda might be a red herring. was that a little too late to the game to try and steer the ship? Or I wonder if there was other things that were there that I don't want to say were missed, but were picked up and the investigator said, yeah, that's not evidence. That's somebody that's trying to steer us somewhere else.
Well, the Papa Roger, right? I mean, certainly if that was him, he was trying to lead and brag and be grandiose and, you know, just like BTK did. Mm-hmm. And just like many others have been done, Zodiac and many others, they love to be able to taunt, mm-hmm, and to just revel in what they've done, only not been caught for. So the Papa Roger always made a lot of sense to me, but we'll see. You know, still, we don't really have that answer. I think we're going to get the answer. I don't think that's something that they would withhold the metadata concerning the IP address for that. At one point, I know that source reporting from within side, you know, was that definitely it was Papa. But since then, there's been other... Mm-hmm. Posts that have come out that many sleuths have said, see, this is Papa again. I don't know. We're going to find out whether he was Papa or not.
I don't know how it couldn't be. I don't see how it couldn't be, or I guess someone communicating with him. That's the only other thing I could possibly think of, which I think that's a whole other road that I there's no evidence really to go down, but how else would you have a caricature of yourself that looks pretty much exactly like you putting out information that nobody knows and nobody knows what you look like at the time? That just, I don't know. It just seems to defy any sort of logic, that it could have been anyone other than Koberger. But at the end of the day, it still plays into the pattern of behavior, whereas BTK was trying to put letters out into the Wichita Eagle through a floppy disk. He's doing the more modern thing and putting it out there on social media. Are you surprised that the criminology students, you know, in 2022 was too stupid to realize that there's IP addresses and that these sort of things can be tracked, which I'm sure... it's probably already been done by now, just not publicly released as of yet.
Well, you know, am I surprised? No, I just think he thought he would never get caught. You know, there's always this delusion of grandeur, that these criminals have. Mm-hmm. They really do believe they're the smartest guy in the room and that they have their tracks covered and that nobody's going to catch them. But, you know, he put out two odd posts also, mm-hmm. One to do with, as I recall, an election and another school board election, I think it was, and another one. I actually contacted the people. I went down this rabbit trail,
yeah,
every single post he made, and I actually ended up getting into contact about one of the posts, and it never made sense because one, I think, was a California deal. It was a political deal. And mm-hmm. then there was another one. I think if I recall right, I called Missouri on. So there were some weird posts that Papa sent out at the same time that really made no sense. So was that an attempt to divert into other directions? I just always found it fascinating. And no matter who Papa ends up being, he would be the number one person I would want to interview on my podcast, other than if it's Brian Koberger, because I would never want to interview him.
It makes you wonder if maybe that was, again, post-crime trying to steer the narrative. Maybe a little bit of, overstepping, if you will, too, realizing, okay, well, I left the sheath. Maybe I need to press the gas over here a little bit harder since I messed that part up. I don't know. Anything seems to be possible in this as we're still learning more and more about it. You can tell a lot about someone by how they react to pressure. In Brian Koberger's case, if the timeline holds, what we are looking at isn't just an alleged killer. We're looking at a man who may have realized far too late that he was already surrounded. Because while he was switching license plates, cleaning out his Elantra, and driving across the country with his father, the FBI was following every move, quietly, remotely, waiting for the moment when they didn't just have a suspect, they had a case. What Jennifer laid out today makes it clear. This wasn't luck. This was methodical. Investigators didn't corner him with a spotlight. They closed in like a fog. They gathered video, tower pings, genetic matches, movement patterns, and in many ways, the most telling evidence wasn't what Koberger did, but what he didn't do. Turning his phone off, changing plates, avoiding known surveillance routes. These weren't random choices. They were behaviors, strategic behaviors. And they told a story. A story law enforcement quietly collected line by line until it was solid enough to move without blinking. What's wild is that Koberger should have known better. He studied criminal justice. He understood investigators, kind of. He'd have known about digital footprints, about car tracking, about cell phone data. But it's one thing to know the system. It's another to believe it applies to you. And that's where it seems the plan unraveled. Not from carelessness, but from overconfidence. He underestimated how quietly a case could be built and how powerful data becomes when you're trying to live invisibly in the digital age. And yet, for all that's known, there are still things we haven't heard from him. No confession, no explanation, no why. And that silence, that blank space in the middle of all this behavioral evidence, it still haunts this story. There's a lot more to come as we continue to break down evidence that has continued to pour in, especially now that the gag order has been lifted. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of that. We're going to be digging into the conversation, talking about that void of motive, into the survivor accounts, the roommates, the texts, the trauma that unfolded around the murder, and what was said or left unsaid in the hours before the crime scene was even discovered. Because catching someone is one thing. Understanding how others lived through it is another. Let me know what your thoughts are in the comments section so you don't miss any of our coverage here on the program. Be sure to press subscribe. And wherever that is, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, hit subscribe. And like I said, if you want to join in our conversations here about this case, do check us out on YouTube for that. Until next time, for all of us here at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for watching.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.